It's a real pleasure to see so many of you here. This morning we had a little session for some of the order members, and there were about 11 of us in this room. And so I was kind of picturing it this evening, and I hadn't quite pictured it being so full. But it's fantastic that I get the chance to see so many of you. And I was also really struck, you know, just in those 10 minutes, just how still it was, you know, how you could have this number of people and just everything went so quiet, so still. You know. You could have heard a pin drop if the aircon hadn't been on. So, yeah, I'm going to spend a bit of time this evening talking about Padmasambhava. And in a way, it'll be more of a sort of personal talk. I'm going to talk more about my connection with this figure. And hopefully out of that, you'll get more of a kind of insider's sense of what it's like to relate to these Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. And yeah, the effect that doing that can have on your mind, on your heart, on your life. So Jnanadara mentioned that I go quite a long way back to the primeval period of Triratna. I was ordained in 1974 at a Sufi farm south of London. I wasn't trying to become a Sufi. Triratna was so small we didn't have any retreat centres of our own at that point. So we were having our summer meditation retreat and we'd hired this place. And six of us were going to be ordained into the order, which was going to take the number of order members up to, I think, 44. So it was almost inconceivably large. Soon there were going to be 50 order members in the world. So there was the six of us who were to be ordained. And the ordination consists of a private part and public part. And the private part is you making your own kind of commitment. This is what you want to do with your life. You want to devote it to freedom, wisdom, love, compassion. And to help him bring more of that into the world. So that just happens with the person who's ordaining you, which in my case was Bhante Sangharakshita, who started Triratna. I won't tell you the whole story of the evening. It was a bit painful, actually, because there were six of us and we didn't know what order we were going to be ordained in. So I kept waiting. One person would go out and come back and I'd be sort of building up to a great emotional crescendo because I might be next. And I wasn't first, and I wasn't second, and I wasn't third, and I wasn't fourth, and I wasn't fifth, I was last. So by the point that I went out into the night, I'd had four major emotional crescendos, and I'd been sitting for about 2.5 hours trying not to move. So yeah, I was in an interesting state. So I walked out through the dark into this little wooden hut where I could see candles just burning, and sitting there with Sangharakshita, and we had the private ordination, and I committed myself to go for refuge to the Three Jewels. But also as part of that private ordination, I was given a new meditation practice. I was given what we sometimes call a sadhana, which means in this case means the visualization and mantra recitation of a Buddha or Bodhisattva figure. Yeah. But that's rather a mouthful, so I'm going to refer to it as sadhana, yeah, which literally means something like a means of accomplishing what you want to accomplish. Yeah, through. So in that little wooden hut with Bhante Sangharakshita, he just gave me the mantra when the time came. But before that, we got to that point in the ceremony, and he said, is there a Buddha or Bodhisattva that you feel particularly drawn to, that you'd like to do the practice of? And at that stage, unfortunately, there weren't any really good books like Meeting the Buddhas. So I wrote the book that I really wanted, you know, when I started in. So I didn't know much at all about the figures, but I felt like I was quite sort of lazy and I could do something quite strong. So Bhante said, he just talked about two figures. He talked about Vajrasattva and said that that was about sort of primordial purity, the fact that, you know, on a deep level, nothing, whatever we've done, there's something about our mind that has always stayed completely unstained, completely fresh, completely open, and the practice involves refinding that. But then there was also this figure of Padmasambhava, who was about spiritual energy, spiritual power. And I still don't know why, but as soon as he said that, I thought, oh, it's got to be Padmasambhava. So he gave me the mantra, and he gave me this name, Vasantra, and I went off into the night, sort of reciting the mantra, alternating with saying, oh, Vasantara, Vasantara, which means universe inside. So I had this new meditation practice, and sadhana is a very rich, very complete practice. There's so much to us as human beings. You know, we're such, you know, often we feel, oh, I'm just, you know, little old me, you know, kind of walking around Dublin. But when we really go into it, there's so much richness, and we're quite sort of mysterious in a way. So we need to really transform all the sort of aspects of ourselves. You know, we need to awaken them. We need to bring, you know, everything that's good in them, you know, to flowering. So there's a physical aspect to ourselves. There's a rational aspect. We think things through. There's an emotional heart aspect, and then there's also an imaginative side to ourselves. Imagination is this extraordinary faculty which very often we take for granted, but none of us would have managed to get here this evening if we hadn't imagined, you know, coming to the Dublin Buddhist Centre on Tuesday evening. And sometimes we use imagination a bit just as a kind of our own personal internal home entertainment system, but it can also be something extraordinarily kind of rich and magical. And then there's also a whole sort of intuitive side to ourselves as well. We can kind of pick up on things and sort of know things which we haven't worked out. And that can be quite hard to sort of follow sometimes, because you can have an intuition, oh, you know, I really should phone somebody, or actually the way my life should go is more like this. But then often the rational bit comes in and says, well, why is that then? And what are your reasons? And the intuitive bit doesn't work like that. So it kind of goes, well, I don't have any reasons, I just know. But the rational bit says, well, that's not good enough. You know, where are your reasons? And sometimes we can just argue ourselves out of deep intuitions and discover that actually they were right all along. So there's lots of different aspects to ourselves. And the Dharma, it works on a sort of rational level. You know, you get hopefully clear teaching about how we cause frustration in our lives, and, you know, how that can all be unpicked, and how we can move along the path in that way. You get teaching about the nature of how things work, how everything is flow, and there's nothing that isn't constantly transforming, whatever it is. You know, you can get teachings on that level. But you also need to kind of affect deeper levels of mind. Somehow those have to be involved. You know, it's like your real sort of deep heart feeling has to be involved. Even your sort of, I don't know, your guts, as it were, have to be involved somehow in the practice, you know, so that there's really a lot of energy going behind your Dharma practice. And when that happens, you know, the whole thing really kind of gathers momentum and it gets really, you know, unstoppable. Yeah. So sadhana is partly a way of talking to those deeper aspects of ourselves. Yeah, there are bits in sadhana which may be you know, more using words and reason. But quite a lot of it is about using things like symbols and mantra, which the rational mind may not kind of get. And again, it may not want us to go there very much because it doesn't understand what's going on. And it's sort of, but something in us actually responds to those things. You know, something in us responds to symbols and so on. So yeah, I took up this sadhana and I started visualizing this figure of Padmasambhava, who we have in as an image and as a picture on the shrine here. And I didn't know much about him, as I say. I knew that there was a historical figure called Padmasambhava who had helped establish Buddhism in Tibet, who'd come from India. But this sort of visualization of Padmasambhava, in a way, you're not really visualizing the historical figure. It's almost like you're visualizing something deeper than that. You're visualizing an archetype, a sort of deep kind of patterning of mind. So Padmasambhava is sometimes referred to as a sort of archetypal guru. It's like he's the sort of, that figure is kind of the quintessence of that sort of principle of being taught and almost initiated, empowered by someone who really knows, who really embodies the freedom of life and the love of life and the wisdom, and they kind of communicate it to you so that you start to, it sort of wakes something up in you, those processes of freedom and love and wisdom, they start to happen in you. So I knew that, but I didn't know much else at all. And even with that, I sort of had an idea. I didn't really get the feeling for it very strongly. But still, yeah, I knew that I had to do this Padmasambhava practice. And all these Buddhist figures, they're... Well, if you come upon a Buddhist figure and you've never seen it before and you don't know what it's, who it is, in a way, the question you need to ask yourself is, well, what state of mind would I be in if I looked like that? Yeah, because all these figures are basically mirrors. They're just holding up a mirror, but they're not showing, you know, your everyday face. They're showing your deep potential to become really free, to become fully awakened. They're showing you some aspect of your potential that is there waiting to be unfolded. Yeah. So, yeah, Padmasambhava particularly, I think to start with for me, showed this potential for an energy, yeah, a spiritual energy, an energy that's really in pursuit of the good. An energy that really wanted to put itself at the service of freedom, put itself at the, you know, an energy that would liberate itself from unhelpful views and ideas about the world and limited, cramped ways of being, yeah, which would free all that. Yeah, that was, I think, where I started with Padmasambhava. And actually, my main experience in the early days of doing this practice was almost like there was some... It was happening on a level that I couldn't quite get at, but there was a sense of some deep kind of reservoir of energy, a really sort of positive energy that was just being filled day after day after day as I did my best to do the practice. It's as if there was a deeper energy that I could start to feel almost kind of gathering, you know, sort of within me. And yes, that energy, if I went with it, would take me in very kind of helpful directions. But also, as I went a bit further on, I had a sense of Padmasambhava as well, another kind of these deep patternings of the mind, another sort of archetype, as a sort of a kind of Dharma magician, someone who sort of can really transform things, again, in sort of quite a powerful way, like a transformer of the depths. And yeah, in a way, all sadhanas sort of work, as I say, on this deep level, working with symbols and so on. But there's something particular about Padmasambhava. I mean, he's quite a complex figure. I'll sort of touch on a few of the aspects of the figure as we go on. But, you know, some Buddhist figures, they're very simple. You know, there's just the Buddha figure sitting there, and maybe they just have a begging bowl, or they're just doing something with one hand, and it's all quite simple. Padmasambhava has these different robes that he's wearing, and this lotus cap, and this Katvanga staff thing, and lots of different aspects. He's quite a complex figure. But there was something about him, I don't know whether it was this sort of, he's got long black flowing hair and sort of big golden earrings, and it reminded me of a bit of a poem by Coleridge. Because he's not also just peaceful either. His expression is a mixture of sort of, it's very kindly, but there's a hint of sort of wrathfulness in it. There's something in there which is sort of like not to be messed with. There's something in there which is very definitely a protector, which is very definitely kind of looking at, is very clear about what's going on. So this bit of Coleridge which came to me was, and all should cry, beware, beware. His flashing eyes, his floating hair. Yes, yes, that. Yeah. Weave a circle round him thrice and close your eyes in holy dread. For he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise. So there's also something very blissful about this figure as well. So he wasn't just kind of nice. And he wasn't just even sort of, he wasn't kind of anywhere within sort of like conventional norms. You know, somehow there was a sense that he kind of lived in a sphere somewhere beyond all those conventions. Yeah, there's something a little bit dangerous about him, but actually really trustworthy because he's an expression of enlightenment. Yeah, he's completely loving, completely on our side. No. But still, yes, you wouldn't sort of take him for granted. You would have to be prepared to open to the fact that the practice might take you into areas where you didn't really like the look of them very much, but you have to trust and go with it and discover that actually this was taking you somewhere really helpful. Yeah. So there was that quality of something about a magician, something about things that could just transform and be really different in there for me about Padmasambhava. It's a bit like Padmasambhava was prepared to stop at nothing to set me free. Prepared to stop at nothing to set us free. Yeah. Whatever it takes, you know, however much I might want to sort of bury my head in the sand and, you know, sort of drag my heels and just, you know, have to be kicked, you know, taken kicking and screaming down the path, he was still going to get me down that path, you know, because actually that was, when we got there, I would be so grateful. Yeah. So whatever it took to see the truth, and whatever it took to liberate the love that's kind of longing to kind of come forth from our hearts, that's what Padmasambhava is kind of prepared to do. So, still, although the practice seemed to work away at me, still, I didn't find some aspects of it very easy to start with. I don't think I had any natural kind of facility for visualizing. I'd I could sort of, to start with, you know, part of the practice, the main part of the practice in a way is feeling a sense of presence.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, even if we can't see somebody, it's like you can have a sense of their presence, you know, what it's like to be around them. And yeah, you know, if there was a screen, you know, in front of me here, you couldn't see me and I couldn't see you, but still we'd have a sense of the kind of qualities of one another. Yeah. But part of it, if you can do it, is that you can see the form. And to start with, I couldn't see the form. So it was a bit like painting by numbers.
Yeah.
You know, I had the description and I had a written down, you know, sort of practice. So I'd think, okay, so in his right hand, he's holding a golden vajra, a diamond thunderbolt. It's a very, very powerful symbol. In this mudra of warding off everything that's unhelpful. So I'd sort of see this kind of pink blob where his hand was with a little bit of kind of gold, which was sort of like a vajra, I hoped. And then I think in his left hand, and at the moment I thought in his left hand, you know, the pink blob and the gold, that all vanished again. But still, you know, I kind of kept doing it. And day after day, you know, as time went on, you know, it's like whatever you work with, you know, it does, you do start to develop a facility for it. It does start to happen. So as time went on, more and more, yes, it was more like, oh, okay, there he is. And as the decades have gone on, well, it's more like, oh, there he is, right? You know, it's sort of just very straightforward. Yes, so I wasn't a natural visualizer, but I guess I continued because I believed in it. Somehow, I think from Bhante, who'd done a lot of visualization of different figures over many years, and then learning about his teachers and reading about people going back, you know, 1,000 years, you know, to Tibet and India. Somewhere, I was really moved by the life stories of people who really worked with these figures. And really, I could see that it could really change the whole way in which I looked at the world. So I kept going. And to start with, you know, whatever I saw, it definitely felt as if I was doing it. Yeah, so I would be visualizing Padmasambhava in front of me, and it felt as if I was spinning it out of my own kind of mind stuff. Do you know what I mean? I was just kind of imagining this figure. And I knew it wasn't real because I just imagined it. And as I said, as soon as I stopped imagining part of it, it disappeared. So that it showed, you know, it was just my own energy I was putting into it. But then as time went on, and I got sort of a bit more deeply absorbed, at least at times, it started feeling as if there was more going on than me. It started feeling as if it's almost like the effort that I was making to create this figure was a bit like, it was like creating a portal or something, a kind of a something through which something which was more than what I thought of as me was coming through. So as time went on, it started feeling as if I was contacting something which was way beyond what I thought of as little me walking around London or wherever it was at that point. And it felt as if, yeah, I wasn't doing that. And this is very sort of traditional. The tradition talks about you make the commitment to do the practice and you do the visualization, which is called the commitment being. You imagine that, but then something else starts to come through, and that's called the wisdom being. So these practices, they're a way of contacting, I wouldn't say, you know, something external out there. It depends how, whichever way we talk about this, it's not quite right, because words can't quite do it. But it was as if I was certainly contacting, which I didn't recognise something as me. It's as if I was contacting deeper forces, we could say, within my own mind, my own heart, through making that effort to visualize. And it started to feel as if I was being, as it were, empowered by this figure in front of me, which I'd start off at the beginning of the practice feeling like I was creating. It's like the thing would just have a mind of its own, in a way, or a heart of its own, or an energy of its own. And to start with, that felt a bit scary. And I think one of the aspects of doing this kind of practice, and actually one of the aspects of doing any kind of Dharma practice, is that to start with limited me or limited us, doesn't quite trust the process that much. So it wants to stay in charge, thank you. It wants to stay in control of things. But the whole way in which Dharma practice works is that it is quietly, sort of softly, softly pulling the carpet out from under that bit of us which wants to stay in charge and in control. And you know, a lot of the Dharma is so sort of subtle and so skillful, you don't notice, you know, until actually quite a bit of the carpet has gone. And you're sort of, as it were, sort of suspended. But at a certain point you do realise, and very often then there's, you know, the response of that limited self is to kind of go, you know, what's happening? I'm losing myself here. And you can quite easily sort of bounce back for a little while, you know, sort of back into a sort of closed, more, slightly kind of fearful, hunched up sort of way of being. And when that happens, it's like when you're right in it, you're just right in it, and there's nothing you can do. But when you start to recognise that, when there's a little bit more space about it, then it's like you have to keep coming back to a real kind of kindly awareness for that. You know, it's understandable that it's, you know, going into the unknown isn't there something you just kind of go, ha, into the unknown, tra-la-la, you know, it's that's not how it is. That's not how we are as human beings, yeah? So, yeah, we need to kind of reassure ourselves and be, you know, understanding of ourselves, and yet not let the fears and anxieties dominate, not let them guide our lives. You know, fear and anxiety guide our life. It's not going to guide it anywhere great, let's face it, yeah? And one of the things which helped me was just looking at people that I knew who had been practicing for a long time, who I was sure had kind of been through this kind of stuff themselves. And when I looked at those people, I thought, well, actually, they look a whole lot freer than me. They look a whole lot more relaxed than I am. They look a whole lot kind of more open-hearted and generous and loving than I am. So, all right, I will take a deep breath and I will go in their direction. Yeah, I'll sort of see what happens if I just, you know, go let the practice take me where it wants to lead me. Let it sort of take me by the hand. Yeah. Keep an eye on the time. Ooh, okay. And I also... Yeah, so there were times where I would kind of pull back. Like there was a period where I was using the mantra, you know, it's just like a sort of sound symbol, quite a lot. And I had this image of it as a bit like a sort of a diamond drill or something, which was going really into the heart of reality. And it's like I just keep, you know, the mantra has this word vajra in it, which is like this sort of diamond. It has all the, vajra has all the qualities of a diamond, so it's kind of, you know, it can't be affected by anything, it can't be broken by anything, and of a thunderbolt, so it's got all that sort of power behind it. So for a while I had this image of each recitation of the mantra sort of going deeper into reality. Yeah, sort of. Until one night, I remember I had this dream where the Americans and the Russians, this was, I don't know, you know, way back in the Cold War times still, the Americans and the Russians were drilling to the centre of the earth. And that was actually a really unwise thing to do, because they were going to unleash like the old powers of the Earth, and then what would happen? And the next thing I knew, I was way out in space somewhere, kind of looking down at this from a completely safe distance. And yes, I'd obviously, you know, the carpet had sort of moved a bit too fast, and I just and sort of pulled out of the practice. So it took me a little while of kind of gentle, you know, kind of kindly drawing myself back, you know, to sort of come back to the practice and in a way to do the practice in a slightly softer way. That sort of diamond drill was good up to a point, but yeah, it was causing trouble. There was something a bit too kind of willed and forced about it, a bit too much of a sense of I'm just going to get there, you know. Like you do that sort of marine meditation, you know, soldier, take that hill. You know, sit. Yeah, that works for a while. But then there needs to be more relaxation and ease around it. Yeah, but still the practice carried on working, and I think, you know, as time went on, there was more energy and more creativity and more aliveness even. And I went through various sort of psychological things which were helpful. Like I remember after I'd been doing the practice about 7 years maybe, having a meeting with Bhante where he was talking about the Padmasambhava practice, and I and a good friend of mine, we both kind of had to sort of say to him that on our bad days, that sort of wrathful smile just looked disapproving, and we, you know, we were sort of, yeah, feeling like, you know, we just weren't good enough, and Padmasambhava was sort of looking at us, you know, very disapprovingly, and you could see Bhante sort of trying to empathize, sort of trying to tie himself into the sort of knot where this awakened being looking at you with this wrathful smile, which the smile is just pure love and compassion. And the wrath is a wisdom which is directed against whatever causes you suffering. That's all it is. Yeah, it's just directed at, you know, whatever means that you aren't free. Yeah, he had to kind of work out, okay, so how would you see that as just disapproving? But it's interesting because with any of these figures, you can put they are also mirrors which sort of onto which we put our own psychological stuff. Yeah. So to the extent that, you know, I kind of projected disapproval from other people, I was putting it onto Padmasambhava. But it was great because I knew that Padmasambhava wasn't really disapproving. I mean, an awakened being, you know, is always on your side, is always kind of understanding and loving and compassionate. So if I was seeing him as disapproving, that was a little kind of pointer that there was something I was doing with my own mind, a way in which I was seeing situations which I could learn not to do. So that was helpful. Yeah, and then there were times where I could see kind of views that I must be bringing to the practice. Like to start with, I could feel there was a sort of wariness about me sometimes when I did the practice. It was partly, yeah, Padmasambhava looked a bit sort of dangerous. He wasn't just kind of smiling benignly at me. But also I'd had a kind of Roman Catholic upbringing. And I think out of that, I'd realised that symbols and ritual and things like that all had a lot of power. But I think contemplating some of the martyrdoms and other things that I, you know, put my mind on when I was quite small actually hadn't been particularly helpful. So I had to sort of work through this sort of reaction of seeing, well, yes, you know, these things are powerful and I do need to be aware of what I open to. But actually, in this context, what I'm opening to really is love and compassion, and I can trust it. And that really, that was really helpful, yeah, to see that. I also caught the other extreme, which was the bit of me which was a bit kind of nihilist and materialist, which would go, well, you know, all this stuff is, it's just your imagination. And that wasn't very helpful either, because it was almost like I would sort of compartmentalize. It's like the practice was giving me lessons about things, but it was, and it was lessons about life in general, but I would sort of keep them in this special sort of area of my meditation in the morning where I, and I wouldn't apply them to the rest of the day, because somehow I had this idea that imagination was this sort of, yeah, sort of other bit of life. And it was almost like, you know, this is real life, you know, this is, you know, what you can see and touch, you know, this is the real stuff. And imagination, well, that's just imagination, or a dream, that's just a dream. And I think as time's gone on, I sort of had to unpick that and see that actually our minds can function in a lot of different ways. And as long as we know, you know, where we are, you know, what's been a dream and what's imagination and what's everyday life and what's meditation, they can all be really helpful. So at that point I started really applying the lessons that I was learning from the sadhana to life as a whole, and that was really good. For some people, when you start working with these figures, and yeah, at ordination you sort of get given a practice, but you know, when, as we come along here, you know, we chant mantras, you can use mantra, you can start to feel your way into what these figures are about, and you can start to make a relationship to them. Because it's a way of making a relationship with our potential. It's a way of making a relationship with love. It's a way of making a relationship with freedom or peace or energy or wisdom or, you know, whatever really draws you. So we can sort of work with these things. If you're visualizing a figure like this day after day, some people, the whole thing keeps changing a lot. There's lots of, you know, one day it's like this, and then the next day that happened, and then that day some, you know, there was an elephant there which turned into this, and it's a bit like, it's sort of more of a kind of creative imagination sort of thing. For me, the practice didn't really change. You know, it's like the Padmasambhava that I see now isn't really any different from the one that I was started working with 40 years ago, other than that, you know, it's sort of a lot stable and clearer than it started off being. Just one or two tiny things. Yeah, there was a phase where, just for a little while, where Padmasambhava started to seem really sort of dragon-like. And just occasionally, and there would just be this little kind of whiff of smoke from his nostrils. Or for a while, he'd kind of appear out of it like a sort of bolt of lightning. But most of the time, he was just didn't change. But the feeling deepened and deepened and deepened. So, how are we doing? In a sense, I'll not talk much longer. And some of the qualities, in a way, took longer to come through than others. So it took me quite a long time to realise that within the symbolism of the practice, Padmasambhava is born from Amitabha, and Amitabha is the Buddha of boundless love. And you know, so everything about Padmasambhava is an expression of love, because he didn't look that kind of immediately, you know, sort of just loving. But as time's gone on, it's like that quality is just, yeah, it's, the figure is full of that quality. There's just endless compassion for all that lives. And part of the figure is just that, it's said that in difficult times, either in our own lives or like in difficult times in the world, such as perhaps now, there are certain practices which get stronger, and Padmasambhava is one of those. It's almost like the qualities, the aspects of awakening that Padmasambhava particularly emphasizes are ones which are really helpful in difficult times. It's like there's an energy there. There's a great love, but it's a love which can also really meet difficulties. So say, yes, he's holding this Vajra, this diamond thunderbolt, and he makes this sort of mudra, which is a sort of threatening mudra, and it's threatening the causes of suffering. It's threatening everything that's dark in the sense of unaware. All the ways in which, well, Padmasambhava is partly teaching us, you know, not to get fooled again. Yeah, you won't get fooled again. So that combination of energy and love and that clarity, are very, very strong in the practice. And there's something about really transforming deep energy, you know, even quite sort of raw energy, the sorts of energy which can appear in the world as extreme greed, extreme violence, all that. It's a bit like, you know, the level on which Padmasambhava is working to transform those things. So in a way, it's like Padmasambhava is taking the Dharma into the depths, right, into the sort of roots of life somehow, and transforming and working with those. And I don't know about you, but it feels like at the moment we're in one of those times in the world where that kind of energy is very helpful. So I haven't talked much about all the sort of attributes of the figure. Maybe we will just take this, a little bit of his right hand, right knee, because he's holding this golden Vajra, and that, as I say, is an extremely powerful, energetic, it's the Vajra of truth. Yeah, it sort of shatters whatever is untrue, whatever is false, whatever is really unhelpful. But it's resting on his right knee, and his right knee is in this, it's just sort of hanging down. He's kind of wearing these Tibetan boots, and his right leg is just kind of in front of him, and it's just in this very sort of completely relaxed posture. So it's like this mudra and this vajra, they're not all sort of tense and they're just resting on a basis of complete relaxation, absolute kind of ease. Yeah, it's not a struggle. It's because Padmasambhava isn't struggling against things on the level on which they're presenting themselves. So that energy, that very powerful energy of Padmasambhava comes from complete relaxation. And in a way you could say the complete relaxation comes from really resting in the truth of how things are. If I had longer, I could talk a lot about the sort of the wisdom aspect of the practice, because these figures also, this figure of Padmasambhava appears out of vast blue sky, sort of complete openness of mind. And the whole figure is made of light. So the figure is showing you the nature of how everything is, actually. We tend to feel, well, you know, life is sort of solid and it's reliable and we can hold on to it. But that always seems to end in tears. We then sort of treat something else or someone else or some situation as if it's solid and reliable and we can hold on to it. and then it, something changes, and so on and so on. It's like we're constantly, you know, sort of that desire to kind of fix things is like, you know, trying to hold onto a bar of soap. It just kind of, you know, keeps everything sort of slips through your fingers. You know? So another of the lessons, and maybe probably the last lesson I have time for, of the figure, is something about learning to see, well, that the all these figures are showing us how everything in life is, and they're kind of training us to live life without suffering. Yeah? And living life without suffering means seeing the nature of how things are, and when you see that actually everything is constantly transforming, there's nothing about us that's fixed, there's nothing about life that's fixed, it's all flowing, it's all kind of ungraspable, just like this wonderful figure of Padmasambhava, but it's just made of light. You know, you can't just, you know, take him home and sort of put him on your mantelpiece. He's not like that. When you see that, then it's like you learn to just really appreciate the figure. You can enjoy the experience of Padmasambhava. You can be really deeply moved by the figure of Padmasambhava, affected by it. You know, you can really sort of take in the energy of Padmasambhava. But there's nothing you can actually hold on to. So if you can just have that attitude of just appreciation and enjoyment and opening without, you know, trying to grasp onto it, then everything goes, the sadhana goes really well. But that's true of life. Yeah, it's like the sadhana, you know, Padmasambhava is trying to show us that life can be fine, actually, you know, with all its difficulties, with all the, you know, all the difficulties in the world. What really makes life painful and difficult is that we treat it all as real and as if we can hold on to it and fix it. But when we learn not to do that, when we just allow it to be a flow of experience, and we appreciate that flow of experience and we enjoy it and we do what we can to help it to go in positive directions and we really open our hearts to it, then all is well. So, yeah, there's a lot of learning that can happen out of interacting with one of these figures. And I could sit here and talk for days probably. But I hope I've said enough to give you some kind of sense of at least how just interacting with this one figure over time has, you know, been like opening some kind of jewel box and discovering more and more and more over time. Yeah, and there's no end to it. Yeah, it's like opening the jewel box of the heart, the jewel box of the mind, and discovering that there are kind of endless treasures in there. And yeah, using mantra and building relationships with these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is one way of contacting the potential that all of us have. Yeah, and beginning to enter a world that's a whole lot freer, a whole lot more open-hearted and loving, where we are seeing things much more clearly, and where we can be transformed and we can really be a resource for other people and for the world.